It is Saturday, February 23rd, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 889 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twins.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is software engineer and political junkie, Miles Elam. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And we also have Bonnie Jean Primsch, broadcaster, large mediator, and printmaker.
Good morning.
We're going to start with you, Bonnie, because you're talking about doodling, and I love doodling.
Well, I'm a bit of a doodler. I draw a thing every once in a while, and one of the alternate reality geeks that was on a couple of weeks ago, James, pointed me to this 3D printing pen, the 3D doodler, the 3 doodler, I suppose it's called. Not an actual hot glue gun, apparently. Although working from the same principle, you've got a rod of the right kind of plastic going in and hot gooey plastic going out, and it holds its shape so you can draw in space, or you could, you know, trace something on a piece of paper,
yeah.
And then once it
it's what we've all tried to do with a hot glue gun and
wait,
never really
achieved.
Draw
in space?
Draw in space.
It's kind of a trip. I mean, it's if you haven't used a hot glue gun, it's really hard to describe unless you're a cake decorator, right? But
yeah.
It's very much like a cake decoration thing, just that it happens to harden. It hardens fast enough such that you can go vertical.
Yes.
Off the table surface.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, we'll link to a thing that shows a little Eiffel Tower that was apparently made with a 3D pen. I would like to know how they got the really crisp lines.
Yeah, it looks pretty clear that they made all the different surfaces flat, and then they put it together.
Oh, and then you can stitch them together.
Yeah, I think that's the way it worked. Yeah. Cheaters.
Very makey.
But speaking of like printing things, well, I guess that's not really a printing if it's a pen.
Yeah, but it's sort of
it feels 3D-ish, doesn't it?
3D drawing.
Miles, you had a story about printing 3D type stuff, right?
Yes, I do. Printing life.
What?
Like the game?
Biohackers what they're calling themselves, biohackers, took an inkjet printer, modified it so that it printed cells. Living cells. And so you, what they were doing was, and this is actually not something that's new. This is something that has been around for a little while. What's different is that they did it for $150 in materials.
Oh, so people have been secretly printing life for a while now? I'm
well,
a little creeped out.
People have been printing materials to make like cartilage for replacement ears or nose pieces, and stuff like that. This makes it a lot cheaper, but it's also just, you know, a lot of fun to be able to print bioluminescent E. coli to write messages up on a petri dish that says, I love BioCurious.
It's the new lemon juice that you hold up to light. Is it? You could write secret messages.
And nice job, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Well, I mean, you mentioned ear cartilage, like that's a thing. But, I mean, that news is also this week. From like the 23rd of this week or so, that the research Lawrence Bonisser created a piece of cartilage from an ear with a 3D printer.
So yes.
Printing cartilage. And I don't think we've covered that before. We've covered like titanium jaws being created and printed.
Right. But the person who made the ear used some very, very expensive equipment, very specialized, whereas this was off-the-shelf components. So
right.
You're seeing this convergence of, you can make an ear for $150. You know,
it's funny because I'm thinking as Don's standing next to me. If you're not listening to the Don's radio show, which goes on before us, and you can find it at kosb.org. Ask Dr. Don, the producer for that, just jumped on. Hi, Charlie.
Hi there.
What's a 3D printing life thing? Why are you curious? What do you get to say?
Exactly. No, I heard something really, really interesting this week. PBS has been doing a lot of coverage because of the shootings in Newtown. And they've had all sorts of documentaries and things. And I think it was the Frontline documentary that pointed out something really, really scary. With these 3D printers, you can basically reproduce guns, including automatic
weapons.
We
covered that story a while ago.
Did you really? Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sorry I didn't hear
it. No,
anything.
It's okay. It's okay. You're a busy
guy. But it's just, you know, the general lesson, every technology has a good side and a bad side.
Yeah. Well, you're assuming that printing your own gun's a bad thing? Oh, wait. I see
well,
the problem.
Not just,
or that ear cartilage is good. What about ear cartilage guns? You yeah, guys, watch out.
But also not just printing guns.
Thank you,
guns.
Charlie, for joining us for a second. Appreciate it.
Not just printing guns, but also you could buy, for example, an AR-15. And because the legislation is talking about banning magazines greater than, you know, 10 rounds, that type of thing.
Right.
It's not as big of a deal to print a magazine that holds 30 rounds
right.
as it is to purchase to print a whole gun. And because these printers are home devices and they are out there, and if you want to spend the money, the genie's out of the bottle,
yeah.
it appears.
Well, I've always
we need
curious.
To have a different conversation than banning the gun parts.
You know, as we've talked, as you know, the gun legislation stuff has come around a lot. I've been hearing a lot of debate about it, and it really comes down to the legislation of selling and the production and selling of firearms. But when it comes down to it, it's not hard to actually, at your own home with conventional tools, make a firearm. It's not easy by any means, but it's not like it's impossible.
Yes,
you just
but
need some machining.
It is extremely difficult to build an AR-15 in your own home.
Exactly, an AR-15. I would say it's getting less and less so. I mean,
yes.
Even if it's kind of hard to print it and get it structurally hard enough, like the barrel is always kind of an issue. It's not something you couldn't do with a little bit of time and money. You know, I mean, let's say me with an Amazon account with maybe I don't know a couple $1,000s. Could be making guns within 3 weeks. It's not like it's that complicated. And that's the thing that's always concerned me is like we make all these rules and such, but in reality, it's components and machining and building and the tools necessary to get that stuff you can buy. So now it's even easier. You don't have to have any technical skills. You just print a printer, you know, send mm-hmm. to print. But it's always been the case that you're capable of doing those
right.
things.
Right, and here's a major concern I have with this, which is it's going to go down the road that home chemistry sets
right.
went down.
That's the thing
which
that's
is instead of saying, yes, this technology is around and let's learn how to deal with it and educate people so that we can make informed decisions. And instead, you had people, we had in the wake of 9/11, banning home chemistry sets, the type that people grew up with in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
To learn about chemistry.
Right. So that a home chemistry set that you buy today is essentially useless for educational purposes. That you would end up with the same thing for, you can't have a 3D printer. No, those are restricted right. materials. And
we're not there yet, right? I mean, we'll get there, but we're not there yet.
To be able to print guns or to be able to restrict the creation?
The restriction of it, right? Yeah. I mean, there's just like a new slate of patents that have come out to try and maintain a little control over who gets to print what.
Right.
Right.
But there's a copyright issue there.
But we haven't had a school shooting, for example, of someone who made it with a 3D printed gun. As soon as that happens, I believe that conversation will begin. And I think we should kind of nip that in the bud and figure out constructive avenues for that. Rather than outright banning, which will be on the table,
I think, Miles, that the issue is will the features of 3D printers become so ubiquitous and wonderful in our society prior to that fear that it will be ridiculous to try to remove them? I mean, the amount of people that die in automobile accidents doesn't produce an effect politically.
But that has
of
to do with
banning
how many
cars.
Makers there are in society. For example, I could make the argument that chemistry is extremely ubiquitous in our society, basic chemistry and knowing that, and yet chemistry sets are now restricted. So having found the justification, even if something is popular,
I wouldn't say that chemistry sets are restricted. I would say that chemicals are restricted, and some of those are necessary in education of chemistry.
Yeah, essentially I say that gets rid of a chemistry set and makes it a bubbling lab.
But we're seeing the same kind of problem in the 3D printing control problem is an issue about general processing computers as well. It's that once you start producing machines and devices and then allowing people to do anything they want with them, you will see things like 3D printers emerge.
It'll be the range.
Right. You don't have to actually purchase a 3D printer. The parts necessary for 3D printers are things you can make and buy. Like the MakerBot, for example.
People do. I mean, there's like a subset of people that are makers, and they will, and everybody else will not.
Yes, yes. So it's really about the large-scale distribution of
these things.
There's
a subset of people that are makers, and then there's a subset of the makers that have the ability to machine tools.
Right.
As opposed to
Is this another 2% thing?
Yeah, it is.
Start chewing on the 2% probability that something will happen.
I just heard, you guys were talking before, when I came in a little late, and you guys were chatting about the New York Times and Tesla, and I'm like, what? Please fill me in.
Elon Musk, who is the CEO of Tesla Motors, the guy behind it all, as it were, the Tesla Roadster, the Tesla S.
Yeah, it's like the electric vehicle.
The electric vehicles. The electric vehicles that perform very well and have a non-trivial range.
Right.
And also cost an arm and a leg. Yeah, so if you have $100,000 laying around, you could get a Roadster. If you have $60,000 just, you know, out there, you could get a Tesla Model S sedan.
He's been checking prices.
Interesting.
Well, that's the low-end one. If you want to go the high-end, you go $85,000.
Anyway. Okay. To sell something like that, you need good reviews.
It's true.
Well, yes.
Before I spend $85,000, I normally check
reviews.
I want
to know
that somebody else likes this car. Did anyone like this car work?
Tesla had some issues in the past with a TV show called Top Gear, a UK show about high-performance vehicles. Sometimes high-performance, sometimes not, and testing them out. And the big argument came from the fact that Top Gear showed a sequence where they said, oh, the car ran out of gas, and it showed them pushing, or ran out of charge, and it showed them pushing the car back into the garage.
Which was not, I'm assuming, okay with Mr. Musk.
Which was not okay because, one, it didn't run out of charge, and they were pushing a charged vehicle as though it had run out of charge.
For the entertainment value.
For the entertainment value. They had already written the script before they got the car.
Of course, that is the fear of electric vehicles, is you can't just pull into a gas station and fill up.
Right. Yeah. And so while it is optional for purchasers of Tesla vehicles to have logging turned on and it sends it off to Tesla, it saves it as in a little black box and sends it off. For whenever they, because of that, whenever they give it to news organizations now, to the press, they leave logging turned on so that they can have, we have this record that this didn't happen. This is not the way that they said it.
So Tesla's making a record, or the, who's making a record?
Tesla's making a log of how fast the vehicle was going, where it was, what the charge level was.
Which, and,
so
which
they're
tracking
their own car when it's out there.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're enabling that by default when they give it to the press, which makes sense, right? You're going to get the vehicle back.
Right.
You're loaning it.
They do it for customers, but it's an opt-in for customers.
Right.
Customers don't have to do it. If they want to, they can, and then they can get information from
Tesla
saying you're
the Tesla company turns on logging of what happens to the vehicle to basically protect themselves in case the journalist lies about the review.
Or there's some confusion.
Discrepancy.
And
all right.
That's where this discrepancy comes in, is this particular New York Times journalist was saying, I was running out of charge. I had to turn off my climate controls. And so I was really freezing, and I dropped down to like 45 miles an hour. And I had big rigs like passing me, and it was really scary.
I read that article.
And
or saw that post or something, yes.
And then I ran out of charge, and I had to be towed back to towed to a charging station, which is the big
concern. That's a pretty negative review for electric vehicle. Yeah,
right. And one of the things that it was testing was what Tesla calls the supercharger network, which is this 440-volt or 480-volt charging station that can charge your vehicle to 80% within a half hour.
Right. So basically, if as long as you get to one of those, you're good.
You go there, right. you grab a bite to eat, and then you come back and your car is ready to go for another 250 miles or whatever it may be. And so Tesla went back, checked the logs on this because it was a very negative review, and went, well, wait a second. From this log, in this time that you were saying you dropped down to 45 miles per hour, it says that you never dropped below 60. And then it talked about climate controls. That was a little bit fuzzy because the time he said that he turned off the climate controls to save power, it was actually a little bit later that he dropped the climate controls.
Yeah.
So that was just like
So they're doing some fine-tuned squibbling over what happened when.
No, for the temperature controls, yes. But with regard to the route that he took, the time they took for that, for with regard to the how much charge he was putting into it, like, for example, he said, yeah, I charged it up, and yet, according to Tesla's logs, the battery was not charged beyond something like 30%. And then he goes off on this long stretch, which is supposed to be, I forget how many miles, something like 70-mile stretch to the next charger. And the vehicle is telling him before he even starts the journey that you have, you know, half that charge of it, half the charge available to make that distance.
Okay.
And why anyone, if they are given that information, why they would even begin the journey knowing that they would get stranded? Like, why would you even do that?
Right. So this assumes that he understood that that information meant something, that he should decide to do something.
Right, and there's some he said, like, he talked to Tesla, called them up, and then Tesla operatives told him to do certain things, which Tesla is going like, wait a second, that never happened. We never told him to do that, you know, that type of thing.
Okay.
And so it's this curious thing where you have a journalist working for a major news organization, mm-hmm. working, and he was working for the pad and paper. Like, he's saying, like, this is the time, this is what's going on, and this is a common thing.
Right.
And what it does in the wake of, here are the data, here are the logs, and reconciling that, and how that changes journalism. Like, how that affects, here's the story.
Well, what's now, considered an accurate story.
Right. And also, it should be noted that this journalist who wrote the article has a history of writing negative electrical vehicle stories. Mm-hmm. So the New York Times editor has not said, like, this person made stuff up. They were saying, well, there seems to be some...
It's also really interesting that how quickly the dialogue about this kind of stuff happens, right? There's this whole... That's the thing that happened with this, the explosion on Twitter, you know, of people giving their opinions that are, well, wait, is that a conclusion of what actually occurred? Was there a real log that says all of these things? Is that been released? And then, of course, part of the claim is that the issue at hand, of course, was the reporter's experience in trying to deal with Tesla over the phone. Theoretically, they gave him a detour, which was incorrect. You know, there's like another level of issue there as well.
Okay, yeah. So did Tesla provide him with the information he needed?
So I'm sure we'll have more information about John Borders' story in New York Times and Tesla as we find out what New York Times actually is going to how they're going to respond. Because, of course, this is one of those things an editor is going to respond to.
Right. And the CEO of a company has a fiduciary incentive to say that, you know, the story is wrong. At the same time, you can have that he said, she said, but if there's a piece of the log that flatly contradicts something else, it makes you wonder, like, you either have a car company completely manufacturing a log,
right,
a log file, a data log, or the journalist is was wrong. Like, mm-hmm. just misremembered facts as they were taking them down, or the journalist was lying. So these are the three possibilities.
Yeah.
It's Rashomon all over again.
Being a geek, I'm tending toward the bias of I believe the logs.
You're listening to Geek Speak. Yeah, I tend to believe that way as well, but we'll see, I'm sure. Thank you, Miles, for that great report. We will cover some more news, including something about JavaScript, which is compelling to me, Miles, some ASM. I don't know what that is, but that sounds cool. All right, Bonnie, what's this big party on March 1st and 2nd or so?
So it's called BarBot.
I'm listening.
What do you think it's about?
I would say it's about robots.
Drunk robots.
Drunk robots. Like data under high gravitational
flow. It is about robots who aim to please. BarBot is a gathering of basically cocktail robot technology, gentlemen.
Nice.
Yes. It's in San Francisco.
So it doesn't matter how drunk everyone gets. The robots will take care of everybody.
Yeah. And a part of their sort of publicity for this event says that these robots don't clean the carpets. What they will do is much, much better. They make you a drink. Let your roommate do the vacuuming. The robots have better things on their mind. And actually, I know a guy who's working on, he says there'll be two, maybe four different kinds of cocktail robots that he's working on.
Wow.
He is, I guess, one of his projects is Party Robotics.
You know, it's really interesting because when the first, like, bartender robot I saw, you know, we probably covered on the show maybe 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. When we covered that, it was like, oh, that's great. That's awesome. And then over the years, I've seen a lot of these things be produced.
It's
like,
a whole
it seems
thing
to
now.
Be a pretty common thing.
Yeah. It's like a subset of a cool thing to make.
It makes a lot of sense because, of course, a lot of robotics are put, I mean, a lot of the technology we see in manufacturing has to do with robotics. They're all pneumatic controlled or liquid controlled. And therefore pump systems and those kind of, you know, liquid management systems seem to be part of the robot industry in a lot of ways.
Right.
The thing that concerns me is that all the hacking I've done on robots and students that I've worked with have done on robots have been a very messy, dirty process, right? You got grinding bits, the laser cutter's spewing out stuff all the time, and you're making really nasty things. Yeah. And the idea that, okay, now we put liquid through it. I just hope the first liquid they put through is like benzene or something, something that will purify the system prior to throwing alcohol. I guess alcohol kind of purifies itself.
Never drink the heads. Never drink the heads.
Exactly.
They say that if you do like a distillation process, you know, it heats up to a certain temperature, and the alcohol that come out right at the beginning are not quite up to temperature and should not be consumed, not really.
Right.
As it turns out, they're pretty good for flame throwing and things like that. And sanitizing equipment.
Ah, that makes sense,
but
yes.
But not really meant for consumption.
For drinking. All right, so this is the BarBot gathering, according to Google search on it. Our GeekSpeak website has got some problems, and I'm going to go into that in just a sec. But for right now, you can go to robotgames.net/barbot.php to learn more about it, or just do a Google search on BarBot. Or a Yahoo search or a Bing search on BarBot San Francisco. The other technologies used in robotics a lot is espresso machines. It seems like, well, it's not really robotics. It's interesting because the decision on where robotics and really fancy machine comes in is kind of a difficult one. There's always a debate about that. But in any case, let's move on a little bit. I just want to mention that the GeekSpeak website, we had this major vulnerability hit the Ruby on Rails community. And Miles, I think you were pretty eloquent on it before the show.
Well, hold on.
Started laughing at me, I think.
Let's just think of the non-geeks for a second.
All right.
Ruby on Rails is a programming language.
Ruby is the programming language.
A programming language. I think its name comes from Perl, which is another programming language. It's kind of a make fun of that.
Yes.
And, so then why do we hear Ruby on Rails?
On Rails is a framework for building websites using Ruby. And the Rails concept is that it's very structured so that you don't make a lot of decisions. There's a lot of opinions in it. And therefore, it's very fast to initially start working on a Rails application.
Okay, so there's like pre-made stuff in that structure and you're compiling.
Yeah. It's kind of akin to you having somebody else make a loom for you and you can now weave.
Okay, got it.
Right, it's...
You can go wherever the tracks lead, but if you want to go someplace else, it's a little hard.
Yeah. Unfortunately...
You have to 8-bit it.
And unfortunately, lately, the tracks led to a major security vulnerability that everybody was affected
with. There was a gap
in
the tracks.
There was a detour that revolved going through a nasty part of town where people could just take your money and you didn't know about it.
And so this is not just at geekspeak.org, but anyone working with Ruby
everybody.
On Rails is having
problems. And Twitter would have been affected, except for Twitter actually moved away from Ruby on Rails a while ago. It started as Ruby on Rails app. In fact, a lot of online services that we kind of know as kind of new and hip, if you will, were Ruby on Rails app at first, and sometimes they still are. I think GitHub, for example, is a Ruby on Rails app. Yeah. And GitHub actually had a problem with their service. GitHub's a major software development resource for programmers. And they had a major security flaw, which was kind of their fault, but kind of led from Rails. Mm-hmm. This one is completely the Rails core developer team missed something.
Whoops.
And do you hear why, Miles? It's pretty cool. It's XML parsing, baby. Always is.
What are you geeks saying?
I think it'd take too long to get into the detail exactly what that means. But basically, you can post different types of content to the web service, and there's an interpreter in there that will actually allow that service to start executing Ruby code on the server. Okay. And therefore, it's very much like the Java exploits we talked about a while ago.
They're allowing executable Ruby embedded within the XML?
Why not, baby?
Let me count the reasons.
I think they figured that out. It's actually any posting of XML or JSON data to the service, you could include a YAML file that would get processed. And unknown to most people, you can actually create arbitrary objects in YAML in the syntax, and they get instantiated.
Right. So folks out there...
You follow that, buddy?
No.
Okay, folks out there, just a general programming rule. Doesn't matter what programming language you're doing, what environment you're doing it in. You never allow executable code... from the public.
Right.
Ever.
Because it's too much room for tinkering, is that why?
It's all the room for tinkering, yeah.
All the room.
You're basically saying, here, please control my computer for me. Won't that be lovely?
Okay, yeah.
Giving the keys, you know, taking copies of your house key, throwing around Times Square and say, just go to my house to do legitimate tasks.
Honor system.
That's really what it is. It is.
Absolutely.
And of course, things at my house.
Of course, it was a major bug that people didn't get to, and now they've figured out.
Is that the thing?
It's a bug. They should never have allowed this kind of feature to exist in the system.
Right. And imagine there are a whole bunch of keys lying around in Times Square, but you don't know whose house it belongs to.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the computer world is like. You don't necessarily know which house is vulnerable.
So I sat on this for maybe a day or so because I have, you know, I haven't moved my Ruby Rails environment from my one machine to another machine, so my primary machine doesn't have it on. And then I'm listening to a Ruby on Rails podcast last night, some group that I like, the Ruby Rogues podcast, and they're talking about the actual vulnerability, and they get into the detail, and I'm like, yeah, I should probably fix this. So I took a computer off, I took an app offline at work at UCSC, and then the GeekSpeak site, I just came home before eating dinner, I just patched it. Mm-hmm. So it's patched. Patched in such a way that's safe, but not very functional, and hence
safe mode.
Hence, we don't have a lot of content for GeekSpeak today. All right, on the website, Miles, yes. Mr. Awesomeness. We're talking about programming. Please do tell us about asm.js.
First, I'm going to give some background here.
All right,
I'm going to talk about a library that's been out for a little while now called mscripten.js. What this is it takes C++ or C. an OpenGL code, and rewrites it as JavaScript. And the reason behind that, you would have older software packages like Quake 2, mm-hmm. old games, and you can run it through this, and it will get you 90% of the way to having something that works, something that can run in a modern browser. So taking older items and bringing them forward, or taking an existing code base and making it so it's available for the web platform.
Okay. So it's like an updater in a way.
It's a translator. It's
got
translating.
It. It's a babblefish.
Yeah.
Understood.
And people have referred to JavaScript as the assembly language of the web. Assembly language being that low-level language to talk to a processor. This is a level below, say, C or C++.
You know, Miles, I'm slowly seeing you dig a hole deeper and deeper. And at some point...
Yes.
At some point... It's just ground with a hole, and Miles is down there somewhere. We know. Are you still alive?
So assembly language, also referred to as ASM.
Ah.
And so now there's this library called ASM.js. What it does...
.js is the extension commonly used for JavaScript.
Yes.
Got it.
It takes a subset of JavaScript, a bare subset, very strict subset of it, and uses that as a profile, which it can pass on to... either a compiler or a web engine, and say, I am a safe subset of JavaScript. You can optimize the hell out of me.
Is this kind of like strict?
Only more so.
Okay.
Yeah, only it's actually not meant for individual users to write by hand.
Okay.
It's made for things like mscripten. That's going from one other language to go to make the most optimized path it can.
Okay.
And some folks at Netscape, Firefox, Mozilla have written a prototype using their own JavaScript engine to accept that if something comes in that's flagged as ASM compatible,
mm-hmm.
that they'll optimize it so that they'll skip all of the possible paths that flexible JavaScript can have. And they've come out to something that comes as half the speed of native C. Now, when we talk about... Yeah.
Wait, so why is that exciting?
Because in general, when you have something like a scripting language, when you have Python or Ruby or JavaScript, and you compare it with with C programming,
uh-huh.
you're not talking about a twice as slow or something. You're talking about 100 times slower.
Okay, so assembly language is known for being just really treacly slow.
Assembly language is the lowest level that you're talking to the hardware.
Assembly language is very fast. Oh. The issue, this is the comparative that we'll go into. If you've played like a first-person shooter on a machine, mm-hmm. the reason why the performance is so awesome is they're writing all that in native, and they're compiling it natively to the processor and the graphics card.
Okay.
So that the machine code that's actually going in is extremely specific to that hardware. So the hardware is running it as fast as it possibly can.
Okay.
In a scripting environment, like any website that you're actually viewing something in, the language that you can actually run is called JavaScript, and that is actually interpreted by your browser engine, and the browser engine is actually written natively. But that interpretation step is about 100 times slower.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't see first-person shooters
in a browser.
Nowadays,
browsers have gotten so good that they're really now good. Only 15 times slower.
Right.
You know,
but still an
like
order
that.
Of magnitude.
And so this is knocking up to just half as slow.
Right,
yes.
But that means it's comparable.
Yeah,
in a computer term, half the speed is
It might as well be the same.
It might as well be the same. And I know that seems ridiculous, but when you're talking about a tenfold difference, it's imagine the difference between 1 and 2 versus 1 and 10.
Yeah.
Right? That's a big difference percentage-wise.
When you have something that's an order of magnitude, in other words, an order of magnitude means a multiple of 10. So
if you
have something that's two orders of magnitude, that's just a huge speed difference, mm-hmm. 100 times slower. And 10 times slower is still a pretty big difference.
And you know, you can say it pretty easily. And these first-person shooters, they always run at about 60 frames a second, so you can't really tell what's going on. That's
the speed. So it'd be like if someone said, you can have $10 billion or $5 billion, and it would still be awesome.
It kind of, yeah.
But like $5 billion is half as much as $10 billion.
Let me go to the computer game space. You're playing a first person, like a heavy load computer game, and you're running around an environment, that the speed, the refresh rate is 60 times a second. You cannot tell that it looks completely fluid. If you ran 10 times slower, it'd be 6 frames a second. Everything would jitter. It would look like a flipbook.
Got it.
Right? So that's the kind of difference we'd see on a computer. You can't really play the game the same way in a JavaScript environment.
And what Miles is saying is this
little library basically allows you to write JavaScript code that would be, instead of 60 times a second at the high performance, it'd be 30 times a second.
It's actually not a library. It's a specification. This is your language that you can
use. Who's implemented this in the JavaScript WebKit framework? Is it in
V8? It's something that has been pushed forward by Mozilla folks.
Awesome.
It's coming out of the Mozilla lab, so it's a Mozilla JavaScript engine that allows this. But just to also put forth the point of 2 times slower doesn't really matter, is you could have 2 laptops sitting next to one another, and one laptop is twice as fast as the other, and yet they were purchased a year apart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why 2 times as fast doesn't matter. But 10 times
true.
As fast
that's a very good point.
Becomes the laptop 6 years ago.
Okay. Right.
And 100 times as fast is the laptop 15 years
That's
ago.
That's beautiful. Right. That's a beautiful use of what's-his-name's law.
Moore's law.
Moore's law. Thank you. cool. Thank you.
And that's why 2 times doesn't matter, because using a laptop that's a year old
is twice.
Doesn't matter.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Or 2 years old doesn't matter.
It's today's laptop.
Right.
It's close enough.
It's a three-year window is what I know we're talking about.
As engineers say, it's close enough.
So when now things are going to happen just half as fast rather than annoying amount of slower.
Well,
what sort of implications are there in practical terms?
Well, it's just another step in making JavaScript be available as the primary language for things.
Which will mean things like what?
Well, it's already kind of happening. So Windows 8, the most recent version of Windows, the application you actually write in JavaScript. Uh-huh. And because they got close enough with speed, it didn't matter. Like, to run the UI environment in JavaScript makes sense. And you're seeing a shift from like something like PHP to Node.js or Wakanda, which is the application I work for. Well, in web development space, the idea that you're moving towards everybody using one language, JavaScript.
Oh.
And the only way that would work in the client side is for it to be fast
enough. So standardized language means more sort of interactive components. And
Miles, what's the difference?
Sorry, I just have to jump in. Please, it doesn't mean standardize a language that you're writing in. Because there are transpilers that will translate from writing Python.
So what's exciting about this ASM.js thing for
you then? This is writing this common subset that browsers can optimize for. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the source that people are writing from. It just means that this is the web assembly language. In other words, that what you write for your Windows PC would be the same app as what runs on your ARM CPU tablet.
Translation.
So they can talk to each other better.
Translation.
Means the developer can write an app once and it runs everywhere.
And it runs the same speed everywhere.
Okay.
And it's not Java, it's JavaScript.
Well, it runs as fast as that device can go.
It doesn't work. It's okay, cool. I like the idea of thinking about it as an assembly language. It is a lot different to structurally write this way. It's more structured.
Yeah, it is the assembly language of the internet.
All right, very cool.
Okay.
Thanks. So speaking of web technology as the OS kind of space, like Windows 8, the other thing that happens this week is Google released their first laptop that's using the Chrome OS as a mass market laptop, and it's a comparable to a Macintosh PowerBook kind of in its
specs. The Chromebook has been out for a while,
but the new version, the new app, do you want to tell me what you think about it, Miles?
The one with the Retina display.
The Retina display.
That's what you're talking about, the high resolution screen.
Yeah, it's like a $1,400 laptop, so it's a pretty expensive laptop, but it doesn't actually have a real OS, and that's the real problem with it. It's got Chrome OS, And that
is not a real OS?
Well,
it's the one I've been using.
No, you're using Chrome browser on Windows.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right now, you are editing a document that is on Google Docs.
Right.
And you check your email through Gmail.
It's true.
And you browse the web through your Chrome browser.
I admit it.
And and you access your files through Google Drive.
Yeah.
Because all of these features, all of these files exist in the cloud. You know, it exists on some server out there on the internet that you don't have any, you don't care about. It just happens. And that's the difference, though, is that with Chrome OS, everything, all of your apps and all of your data is stored somewhere other than your laptop.
Got it.
Whereas with most operating systems like Windows or Mac or the like, your files are stored on your local hard drive.
And that's going to relate to how Google Glass works, right?
Well, we could go into Google Glass, but the Chrome OS, this idea that Google basically doesn't want you to have anything but a browser, mm-hmm. and they're building a computer that basically only is a browser.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not running Photoshop on that machine.
Right.
Right. You're not running GIMP on that machine. It's just
on
running.
On the contrary, you will start running them because
they'll write it in AssemblerJS.
Well, that and Chrome WebKit has been moving toward having features that were only available in things like Photoshop before, filters and stuff like that.
And more apps are being written natively in JavaScript, HTML5, CSS.
Yeah, you will start
for
seeing
like Windows 8
Photoshop clones in a web browser.
Yeah, well, it's true. All right. I think that you and I, Miles, haven't seen each other in so long. We're just going all geeky.
You're kind of blowing me away, gentlemen.
All right, let's try to take it back to, well, Miles, it's been a while that we've talked about passwords, and you've got a story on here, so.
Yes.
Yes.
Did you hear the news about Burger King's Twitter account getting hacked?
No, what Burger King has is their password.
Well, no, let's first talk about what happened. How did they find out? Well, the Burger King Twitter feed was saying, oh, they got bought by McDonald's.
Oh.
What? Who got bought by McDonald's?
So someone hacked into...
According to Twitter, to the Twitter feed, Burger King was. But they weren't. Their account got hacked.
Okay.
And they went back and said, like, no, sent out press releases saying, like, no, this isn't the case. And then went to Twitter saying, our account got hacked. Please give us back our account. And Twitter then went on to write an article that says, yeah, can you write a better password than I love the Whopper? Where it's a lowercase I and the O was changed to a zero.
Well, and come on, the W's capitalized. That's an extra security measure right there.
Okay.
Don't write a password that has to do with the service you're providing.
Don't
write a password that has to do with your username.
Yes.
Don't have your password be similar to the email address that it applies to.
Don't write a password that you think you're clever with. Cleverness should not exist in passwords. The whole, oh, but it's my dog's last name and I used a W instead of a D because he makes woof sounds. No, that's not smart.
Oh, come on. These magical numbers are going to win me that lotto.
Take a magical number that wins you the lotto. That's a good one.
As long as you're not a public figure like Paris Hilton, which is incidentally how she got her voicemail hacked, was what's the name of your dog?
Oh my God.
But that's old news. If you do that and you're not a public figure and not many people know who your dog is, I could see that as an argument for doing so because it has nothing to do with what you're working in.
Just don't tell anyone the name of your dog. You're fine.
But that's the problem. Yeah. If you're on Facebook, you probably already know
that's
the name
true.
Of your dog.
That's what true. Most else, people do know what your dog is.
If you've got a friend that's got a dog and you know the dog's name and then there's a picture of it and then that person says, hey.
Right, then you're sure.
There's you can't, those questions about security, like where did your mother grow up or all those questions, you basically have to use those as passwords too. You have to write down random stuff to answer those, document it somewhere and use that as your security, especially for your bank. I mean, basically the point at this point is that all of the password hacking tricks and techniques that people do are now codified into really fast applications that do it automatically.
But if you're
so there's
a
no
high
way
profile,
to hide.
Yeah, if you're a high profile restaurant, you don't use items from your menu.
No.
Ever. Like that
password should have been, 20 characters long of random numbers. There's no reason not to. And then you put that somewhere people can get to that need to access the site. Access it. It's ridiculous. Additionally, Twitter supports unique services to have resources, right? So once you activate an app on your laptop or something, it's only that app is activated. It never uses your password. It doesn't need it. So you get to this point where you start having delegated activity on your account without the actual root password. Right. And that's
and
the best way to go.
If you are a large company that has a Twitter feed, because more and more large companies do, you should be setting up an app server in-house. That has username and password for the employees that have access to that Twitter feed. And then the password would be...
is hidden.
Yeah, hidden someplace else through a key. And that's what posts it,
right.
Not
so your
the
user
password
never,
to the individual.
So your individual user never knows the Twitter account. Yeah, absolutely. So Bonnie, earlier you mentioned Google Glass when we were talking about the Google Chrome book. And that was actually my geek bit of the week. And geek bits are basically things we talk about on air, but you really have to see to believe. Yeah. And Google Glass has been working for a while. And Google's been working this product called Google Glass.
It looks like they've been developing it for a while.
Yeah. And I've known a little bit about it. There's little whispers and there's a little bit of discussions about it.
About it this week, you guys.
You got to kind of, well, that's because they finally launched what it's like. Yeah.
And it's an amazing video I saw.
Yeah, that's the one I was going to suggest people watch. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Of just what the different kinds of things you could do with Google Glass. And is this the right analogy that it's like having a browser in your upper right eyeball?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it.
Right?
I mean,
and being able to sort of communicate. It's like Siri is a browser in your upper right eyeball.
And I wouldn't say it's a browser, but it's a window to
it's
an
a
application environment. Yeah.
For anybody who's read the Neil Stephenson book Snow Crash,
right?
Gargoyles,
yeah,
is what they are.
Yeah, in Neil Stephens' Snow Crash, gargoyles are people that have removed their eyes and implanted them with electronic, and they look chrome when people see them. But they're actually able to look at what he calls the net. Does he call it the net?
As you're looking around, you're seeing people's like social security numbers pop up and stuff like that.
Okay,
you're basically information gathering and sending it off to someplace to, and you get paid for it.
You know what? I don't know if their eyes are chrome. That might have been a different
I think you might
book.
Be thinking of something else.
I think so.
This was just you have on these goggles and everyone knows what they are and they make fun
that's
of them
because right,
you look dumb when you're wearing the stuff, but you're basically information.
Geek trivia, which early sci-fi novel that talked about the net used chrome eyes as a piece of technology. So what was your how would you describe Google Glass? How does it look when someone's wearing a pair of these things?
It looks like you've got the top of a rim of eyeglasses, and there's like a little window,
little piece of glass
little
in the upper
of
right of one of those
right.
places.
Yeah,
and that little piece that of glass is a prism, and behind the prism is a little LCD display.
Right.
So though you can kind of see through it, you can actually focus on that content in that window.
Yeah.
And
here's
it
what
overlays information.
Me, gentlemen, is they had in the sort of promotional video, they had people sort of talking to Glass. Hey, Glass, how do I get to blah, blah from here? And then a map would show up in
that
little browser. And given the way that I've seen Google interpret voicemails, I'm not sure that the sort of communication system between a person and Google Glass is going to be that straightforward. It seems like there's room for a lot of glitches there. Of just misunderstanding what you're saying.
Voice command has always been difficult, as we know from all the jokes about Siri responding wrong.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's a couple different things. It'll probably be a feature where you don't actually use voice commands.
Mm.
You can tap it as well, or tap it to then use voice commands. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, like, there's been some reviews after that. I took a look at some other things. Mm-hmm. The other thing that Google's, the reason why they're kind of released the video in the launch is that they're asking now to broaden the developer space. And right now they're basically saying, on Twitter, spread the word about our product.
Right.
And if we like your idea, we'll let you buy a pair of Google Glass for
$1,500.
I didn't know that when I submitted mine. So if I had glass is the hashtag, and mine is if I had glass, I would develop an app to log gas purchased and mileage using OCR. That's optical character recognition. So basically Google Glass has a camera in it as well. You can take pictures whenever you want. So my interface would be, okay, Glass, grab gas pump. And it would take a picture of the gas pump screen.
Uh-huh.
And then, okay, Glass, grab odometer and take a picture of the odometer. And then it would take those numbers and turn the photos into numbers and produce your gas mileage for that trip.
Oh,
right.
Nice.
So basically continually keeping track of that. I do that with photographs anyway. I just hand process them. But in any case, there's a lot of different things for if I had Google Glass. And of course, a lot of things are kind of comical. On the response, right? Anyway, we'll see. I think my general prediction on this, and of course predictions are worthless, is that in the next 5 years, this kind of technology will be as pervasive as smartphones are now.
Hmm.
So that's my prediction, which is completely useless.
What about the already bespectacled?
Well, the already bespectacled, they are working with different companies. They're producing a general glasses frame that you can then embed this in. So you would basically replace your glasses, Bonnie, as a glasses wearer, Miles, with a glasses wearer.
Now combine
with
this
one of these.
With the electronics that are basically temporary tattoos, that would allow communication between individuals.
Yeah.
They've been describing it as telepathy, as geeky telepathy through temporary tattoos.
Wait, through temporary tattoos?
Yeah, you have basically an antenna and maybe a small power source, and it's able to read It'll read your muscle contractions, even if you're not even saying anything. If you have the intention of saying something.
I wouldn't call that a temporary tattoo. Is that
yeah, that seems like an implant.
No, it looks like it. It looks like it, but it's surface mounted.
So it's another interface that's existed in sci-fi for a long time. A Deepness in the Sky by Virgo has this idea that as you get really good with computers reading what you're doing, you can actually get extremely good at telling computers what to do by just movement. So that's in a lot of sci-fi. With this idea that as we have really good scanners in the system, you could theoretically tighten the muscles that Miles and I always played with as kids. This head muscle, what's that called?
It's the tympanic nerve?
The tympanic nerve, which you can actually, if you ever have a rumbling in your ear, you can force a rumbling in your ear.
Yeah.
That's actually tightening the muscles around your eardrum, and that's called a tympanic nerve, I believe.
I don't know.
The idea that you could move a muscle or a muscle group in your body that's so subtle no one could see it except for the computer that was embedded in your body could detect it. So you could potentially browse the web without moving, right? You could tighten muscles in a certain way and phone call somebody. So the idea would be that we're, as a human race, we might get extremely good at that. And we've actually seen that already. You know, the ability for you to use a mouse, the amount of movement you actually do and what you can actually affect mm-hmm. are not the same in scope,
that's true.
Right?
That's true.
And so because your micro movements, theoretically, we could get better and better at doing that. And Google Glass has voice commands, but potentially there could be sensors on your body as well at later dates.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow, we're getting
the
pretty...
The tensor tympani muscle.
Ah, the tympani muscle.
Which refers to the tympanic membrane, not nerve.
Thank you.
The eardrum.
This is, if you were ever, like Miles and I, we found out briefly after a meeting, when we were kids, we thought maybe if we could just do this effectively, we'd have psychic abilities. We could lift stuff with our mind. At least that's what I was thinking.
You thought that. Yeah, you're alone on that one, pal.
Oh, man. Welcome back to the show, Miles. So... Miles, get a couple of quick stories.
Well, I do have. You caught me just around.
Oh,
I
want
to know about analyzing Twitter to find happiest parts of the United States.
Yes, there was some researchers that were looking at Twitter and looking to see where those tweets came from to find out where the happiest places. And that's something that we don't have enough time for me to go into very much, although I do have to say the fifth happiest city is Santa Cruz.
Yay, we win!
Or
the happiest
people
state,
that express...
surprise, happiest state, Hawaii.
The thing is, maybe there's just more tourists there compared to population density, and therefore people that are touring are happy. The thing about those kind of statistics is ridiculous. It's not the happiest place, it's the place that people speak happiest about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it might be...
What is
just,
the difference?
What if people are lying? What if they're having a miserable day and it's just sarcasm? You don't know. It's actually the most sarcastic
question. Yeah, it's that question from bad...
sarcastic. Yeah. I'm sure it is.
It's that question from... that question from bad 80s movies, which is, what's the difference between a little boy and something that simulates a little boy when you can't tell the difference?
Yeah, that was a big theme, as I recall, in 80s movies.
The movie called Daryl.
Daryl, thank you.
A particular 80s
Gosh.
Movie.
Strange trivia references.
Geeky.
So we instantly doubt the stats that Twitter came up with. That's what
I always doubt stats. Statistics are always ridiculous, especially trying to figure out from data what people are thinking or feeling. Please. I mean, sure, I get that if you're saying, what a great day today, and you do that a lot, you're either insane or in Hawaii, but...
I mean, I do know a lot of people. I know at least one person on my Facebook stream who is kind of the prime generator of determined to be happy kind of comments.
Ah.
Like determined to be happy.
And is that person actually happy?
I think she's working on it really
hard.
Does
she think she's happy?
I think she thinks she is.
These are the details that I don't think are taken in effect in this Twitter study.
Exactly. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Miles, you got another one, sir?
Sure. Let's see, whichever one would be interesting and very short.
Pick for about 3 minutes.
Yeah. No, we have less than 3 minutes, don't we?
Now we do.
Now we do.
So let's just talk about iPhones. One, iPhones purchased after this point, you are not allowed to unlock or jailbreak because it would be illegal. There's been a petition that's been posted to the White House website. It's received 100,000 signatures within 30 days, which means that there must be a response from the White House about
Good.
It. I'm curious about what that's going to come out to be
if
like.
If you own something, you should do anything you want with it.
Which is also funny because iOS 6.1 has had a whole bunch of bugs. It'd be nice to be able to...
To patch those ourselves?
Yes.
This is Geek Speak. Everything we talk about eventually will be up at geekspeak.org. In the air with me is Miles Elam. Miles, thanks for being back. It was awesome.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
You're always welcome. And Bonnie Jean Primsch, good to see you as well.
Can I come back?
At some yes, definitely. I'm Lyle Troxell. Geek Speak is a registered service mark by David Lawrence and is used with permission. You can find out everything about us at geekspeak.org. Thanks for staying tuned with us for the hour, and we'll see you next week. See you online as well.